So very good to see you all this evening, and I've just been testing out my maths actually, and am I right in saying it's about 72 hours since we started? Who's math then? It's funny, it's strange to work out, isn't it? Because it can't be that, yeah, I can see a few people counting. I've got A-level maths, by the way. And 3 times 24 is not an A-level question. But it was just, maybe it's a little bit of the state of mind or how it is to be on retreat. I almost can't quite believe it's 72 hours. It feels like so much has been happening for all of us in this time. And just to say what a pleasure it's been to be talking to you all in the groups and one-to-ones, and I'm very aware as I talk to you tonight of just all of the different things that people are experiencing, all of the different challenges that you have in your lives, and it feels quite a responsibility then to say something that feels relevant and helpful in all of the different things that are happening. But anyway, this is... There's a nice phrase sometimes some teachers say, I offer these thoughts for your reflection. So it's a gift. And as is always said in the tradition, please use what is useful and just put to one side what isn't. So I thought I would start this evening again going back to this book, Trusting the Gold. And by the way, actually, a few people have put notes up about references, and we'll give you references tomorrow, so that will be taken care of. So this is back to Tara Brach. And this is what she calls her newspaper meditation. During the weeks leading up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq, led by the United States military, I found myself increasingly agitated. Every day the news headlines were making it clear where all the talk by politicians was leading. I'd open the newspaper and find myself feeling anger and hostility towards those in government who were beating the drums of war. Just seeing their photos on the front page of the newspapers would set me off. At the same time, my book, Radical Acceptance, had just come out, and students were asking me how acceptance and activism could go together. How could we radically accept and seek change at the same time? How could we see what was going on and not do something in response? I was increasingly aware that the hostility I was feeling in my own mind was actually another form of violence. And yet, I needed to stay engaged. I needed to do something, to take some kind of action. Since I wasn't going to stop reading the newspaper, I decided to make it into a meditation. Each morning, I would open the paper, check out the headlines, read a few paragraphs, and then pause. I'd notice my reactions, the thoughts and feelings of outrage. I'd allow the experience to move in my mind and body, not denying it or feeding it, just witnessing the response I was having to the latest reports. I began to see that when I opened to the full force of the anger I was feeling, I could also sense within it fear for our world. And as I opened to the fear, it unfolded into grief for the suffering and devastation that was inevitable in war. And out of the grief arose a deep caring for all beings, humans and animals and trees, that would be harmed by the violence we were moving toward. After a number of newspaper meditation sessions, I had the opportunity to join others in Washington, D.C. to protest the war. We were peacefully arrested, along with the clergy of all denominations, Nobel laureates and elders, all of us expressing our caring for everyone directly affected by this war, soldiers and families, Iraqis and Americans alike. We held with compassion the enormous suffering we knew would come, we held peace rather than violence in our hearts. By holding my feelings of anger and frustration with radical acceptance, I could find my way to the caring that gives rise to wise action. Acceptance of whatever arises in the present moment is not a passive act. Rather, this engaged, mindful presence allows us to respond to our world from our deepest compassion and wisdom. Yeah. Yeah, a bit like Zohar was saying the other day. I almost feel that could be the talk then, really. We could almost leave it there. But yeah, I find it very moving to read that and to really hear that process, and I just wanted to reflect a little bit on it. I mean, one thing immediately that's for me quite uplifting is that you have somebody there who's been practicing for many, many decades. And so then she's describing in her own experience, again, something that I imagine many of us can recognize, the feeling of looking at the newspaper, hearing the TV news, hearing things happening in the world, and all that can bring up and stir up within us. And the process she describes, I think, is quite archetypal, really, or universal, maybe. Yeah, this movement from anger, tracing that, sensing that, underneath that fear, underneath that grief, and with that process, then the outcome being a wise action, a caring action. And I wonder if that's also something of what we've been doing over these days, you know, as we bring friendliness, as we bring metta, as we bring loving kindness to our experience, we can be with those more difficult experiences, the anger, the fear, the grief, and we learn little by little to hold them in a bigger space, to breathe with them, to feel them in the body. And also, we may even say we learn to listen to them. I mean, there's the other lesson I would draw from that. It's not that her initial agitation was somehow wrong or a mistake, but it was telling her something, yeah? Something needs addressing here, something that's not okay. So, but by listening to that, feeling that, not just immediately acting out, but neither suppressing it, listening to what's there can then lead to this action that cares. And of course, I'm also very aware that the war still happened, and I'll come back to that later in the talk. There's another, of course, very important part of this. It also reminded me of another book for the references tomorrow that I'm reading by Joanna Macy, called Active Hope. And yeah, again, to be honest with you, it's something, you know, I'm beginning to explore and read, so some of you may know this already much better than I do. But what really stands out from her work in the initial part is drawing our attention to three stories, and three stories we can find in our modern world. And the first story she calls business as usual. So this is the kind of sense we might have, actually, to be honest with you, everything's fine in the world. I can go to the shopping center and it's all there, there's loads of stuff there to buy, it's all nice and shiny. And yeah, if I'm feeling a bit miserable, I'll pop down there, get some more. I'm sure things will work their way out. Yeah, there are problems somewhere, but they're probably over the other side of the world. It's okay, I've got things to get on with here and now. So this would be what she calls the kind of business as usual perspective. And when that's expressed in sort of theoretical terms or leadership terms as well, it may be the idea that what we need in the world is simply more of the same, really, more technological development, more economic growth, and somehow yeah, everything will be fine, kind of idea. The second story she calls The Great Unraveling. And this, if you like, is the opposite of the first. It's when we start to realize that all of our technological development and economic growth has what we may call a very significant shadow side. That's a bit of an understatement. And we start to be aware of the climate crisis, of economic decline, of the social division, the war, the extinction of species. And these things really, very strongly impacted in us. And very understandably, in this second story, we feel, at times at least, completely overwhelmed. And we may move from that rather complacent sense in the business as usual story, everything's fine, to really feeling a lot of despair, feeling hopeless, powerless. But then she talks about a third story, which she calls The Great Turning. And in the third story, there is what she talks about in the title of her book, an active hope. There's also the sense that there is also something new coming into being, the possibility of something new coming into being, shifts in consciousness, new ways of thinking, challenging old assumptions, the activism many people are involved with. And when you start looking for that, she says, well, actually there's a lot more of that around than we might realize. You can sometimes feel, there's only a few people doing this, but you can actually see this great turning. And I hope it's not too bold to say, in a sense, we've been doing that this week. Yeah, we've actually been doing something quite different this week than business as usual, haven't we? We haven't been saying, right, come on everybody, let's just move faster and buy some more stuff and get more and more busy and more frantic. We've been exploring a different way of being in the world. You mentioned on the very first evening this idea that I've always found deeply inspiring as a joyful simplicity. This idea that a simple life is a life happier for ourselves and for others. You remember Mattia Ricard I quoted, both altruistic and beneficial for ourselves. And there's something very, very powerful in this. I think it's a really significant thing that meditation in general has to offer to the crises and challenges of our world at the moment, because sometimes you can hear the idea, the planet is in trouble, so we need to get rid of all our happiness, we need to give up all our happiness in order to save the planet kind of narrative. But actually meditation is offering a different sense than that, isn't it? It's not this kind of separation between us and the planet as if they're, totally separate things. And also the idea that living in a different way, yes, could be more sustainable and more joyful. And meditation can really begin to give us a sense of that, this great turning. So for me, these three stories are very significant. And a friend of mine who studied this a lot more than me said, actually, we move between the stories, which is interesting. It's not like we're just in one and we move from the others, but we can find ourselves almost at different times in our lives, in different ones. And it struck me, even more so at the moment, that we really need the resources to move us from that great unraveling story to the great turning story. In other words, we need resources to move us from the sense of despair and hopelessness to the sense of joy and possibility and creativity. And I have this sense also, it actually is a little bit, I don't know how the word faith strikes you, but it actually this is where faith comes in. But a faith, I would say, is that despair can never be the end of the story. despair can never be the end of the story. It's very understandable that we move through those places. And very understandable that we need to grieve for all kinds of losses we experience. And we don't overcome despair by pushing it away. In fact, we respond to it as we've been doing all week, actually, with friendliness, mindfulness, curiosity, you know, respecting the process we may be going through. But it's never the end of the story. Yeah. I had a thought, again, with the caveat that if it's not helpful, just put it to one side. But it came to me, this thought, that, you know, imagine, this is a thought experiment, but imagine if you were the only person left on Earth. It was just you. My sense in my heart is that it would still matter what you did. And I can't prove that to you. And in the sense, it's kind of, well, what does that mean? Why would it matter? Nobody else is around. But to me, that's a kind of faith. That then the wish to live beautifully, the wish to live with care, the wish to live with kindness would still matter. And we might even say, you know, again, to be philosophical about it for a bit, the meaning of life, if we think of such a thing, can't just lie in the future. And to say a little bit more what I mean by that. When we take a really cosmological view of time, a vast view of time, actually you take in that the Earth itself is impermanent. Life on Earth is impermanent. You know, there will be a time when life on Earth ceases. And I hope and trust it's, you know, in many countless years' time. I don't know how your cosmology is, but, you know, the sun was born, wasn't it? And the sun will die. And everything on Earth depends on that. So, from one perspective, from that vast perspective, you know, there is that realization of the impermanence of planets and stars and species. But when we take that in, to me, it's really totally consistent with the idea, and this moment really matters. This moment when we're here, we can manifest beauty and care and kindness. And yeah, sometimes we're doing that thinking, oh, I'm doing that in order to get a good result, or is it going to work out, or isn't it going to work out? But there's an even deeper sense that there's just a beauty in doing that. So this seems to me a huge question for us personally and collectively. How do we move from those times of, you know, despair, if you like, to these moments of creativity? And I'm very happy to say that many, many human beings have shown us the way to do this, actually. We don't even have to work it out, which is great. You know, there are these exemplars throughout history. And two of these exemplars, one who's just recently died and one who thankfully is still with us, are the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu. Archbishop Desmond Tutu. And so in the spirit of thinking, how do we move from that place of despair to that place of creativity, I wanted to share some of their thoughts from a meeting that they had. It's been become a wonderful book. And Zohar was also telling me a film of their meeting. Now, the first thing to say about these two, that for me really inspires me, is that they've not had easy lives, right? I don't know how much you know about them, but if you think about being the Dalai Lama, so chosen at a very young age to be a leader, he didn't think, right, I'm going to stand for election. He's picked out, chosen to do it. This is your role in life. And then at a very young age, his country is invaded. And so he flees, across the mountains, flees into northern India. As a young person, now he's in a very different place. You know, I've got all these people depending on me, relying on me, the hopes of the Tibetan people. What do I do? Yeah, how do I make a new life in this new place? Cope with the loss that's happened. And of course, Archbishop Tutu is the, you know, Archbishop during the times of apartheid in South Africa. And part of that struggle for freedom in South Africa. So when these people give lessons, I'm like, okay, I'm going to listen to you, you know. And I hope you listen to me too, but I have, you know, in the big scheme of things, I've had quite a comfortable life. I mean, maybe another day I could tell you my life story. But, you know, had some tough things to deal with, but in the big scheme of things, I've had a, you know, lived on one of the more comfortable regions of planet Earth. So what they're saying, really, as I'm emphasizing this, it's not sentimental. It's not just, oh, you know, these are sort of cheap and easy things to say. These are lessons that have really been tested in the heart of great struggle. And so the first thing that they talk about is perspective. And this is the first of their pillars of joy, is perspective. Changing the way we see the world, our situation, our actions. And so one of the examples the Dalai Lama gives is actually thinking of the gains that he experienced in his exile. So through being exiled and living in India, he actually became in contact with a much wider group of people. It opened opportunities that he hadn't had before. His teachings reached a much wider audience than they otherwise would have done. He had experiences he wouldn't have had in other ways. Now again, for me, I think it's very important not to be sentimental about this. This doesn't mean that it wasn't deeply painful and isn't deeply painful. I think this is really important. So it's not a kind of sticking plaster idea. Oh, actually it was fine. No, it wasn't fine. And, you know, I hold that together with stories of him hearing about what's happened to many of the Tibetans with tears in his eyes. You know, this isn't a cold, cut-off place. Actually, everything was fine. But it is a mind that's able to hold the complexity of that. A flexibility, you know, that capacity to reframe even this most difficult thing as something that also brought some opportunity. And Desmond Tutu, you know, he quoted the example I used the other day about, you know, if somebody's in traffic and driving in a particular way, but he says, you know, when that happens, he might bring to mind, you know, what's happened to the person? And this is imaginative sense. What kind of health or family emergency is happening to that person who's behaving in a way that I, you know, find difficult? This imaginative shift. Another thing I like to do with this sense of perspective, I was already doing it with you a little bit, is this sense of the vastness of the universe. I find this helpful to contemplate. I looked it up, I googled it, like some people do, they say, how big is the universe? Again, it's, if I can't even work out it was 72 hours, I don't know how I'm going to work with this, but basically, I think I'm right in saying that there are thought to be 100 billion stars in our galaxy alone, the Milky Way. 100 billion. That our sun, you know, as they're saying, that we depend on for everything. It's one of 100 billion. And there are said to be billions and billions of galaxies. So again, forgive me if I don't quite get the numbers right, but it's something like the number of stars in the galaxy is something like 10 to the power of 22, 10 to the power of 24, something like that. People disagree. For a non-scientist like me, I'm happy to say unfathomably vast, mind-bendingly vast. And, you know, what does it do to take that in at times? I definitely find that perspective can help me to, yeah, let go of some of the things I find myself worrying about when things get very small, like how much I'm paying for my broadband, or you know, where my neighbours park the car, or something like that. You know, it's like, oh, hang on, I don't need to do that. That kind of smallness. But I do feel also, and again, there's some paradox of this, is that it also invokes in me a wish to care. It's strange, that, isn't it, really? Because you could think, well, you know, if there's only one star in all these billions, who cares? It doesn't seem to have that effect. It's like, ah, this is precious, you know, and vast and beautiful. So the second thing they talk about, the first was perspective, was humility. And the suffering of thinking that we're special. That's really interesting. Whenever you get into that suffering that you're thinking you're special. The Dalai Lama, again, as you may notice if you've ever seen him, can be actually quite mischievous. And I like this about this. And he said he saw a spiritual teacher, he thankfully doesn't name the person, sitting on a high chair. And apparently this person was very concerned about their rank and status, and was saying, I can't possibly sit on that chair. It's not high enough. It doesn't really reflect my rank. So in order to give this person the rank that they required, they had to sort of mount this chair on loads and loads of bricks. So it became really unstable. And the Dalai Lama saw him sitting there. And he had this rather cheeky, naughty thought, oh, wouldn't it be funny if he fell off? again, I don't think that's kind of in a nasty way, but there is something about that actually quite liberating, about sort of bursting the bubble of any sense we feel quite inflated or puffed up. And, you know, it can happen for us at times on the path, actually. You know, particularly maybe there are times where we have quite unusual experiences, or we feel great peace, or, you know, the body is full of lovely tingling energy, or it is possible for at times that then to lead to a sense of inflation. Oh, you know, we, in the Dharma language, we'd say we take birth in that, becoming a person who feels somehow different and special and spiritual. But you know, I love about this that this is really just a reminder. Ah, this is something we can really see through. And the way to see through it, by the way, is really to see that that's suffering. You know, it's actually suffering to feel, because it creates distance, doesn't it? You know, any time we feel we're special and different. And there's a lovely passage there that said, actually, it's when we feel most insecure that we can be arrogant. And the opposite, really, is actually when we start to feel a kind of security, or we might say a basic okayness, which we can touch into in our practice, it leads to humility. Yeah. So, you know, if you think about it, when we're okay, ah, this breath, that's all right, that's okay, just to be here. This cup of tea, you don't need to be somebody special. That again, in the Pali language, we would call it bhava tanha, the craving to be, and can let go of that. Until it comes up again, and then we can let go of it again. The third thing they talk about is humour. And this is, again, made me... ironically, perhaps, made me smile. And you could think about, well, what would be an index of spiritual development? Now, we could have lots of questions and debates around this anyway. I mean, there could be one school of thought that the whole question is a bit unhelpful. You know, we can get into ideas of progress, how much progress have I made, how much development is there, how far have I come, how far is there to go. And yeah, maybe one perspective would see that whole something unhelpful about the whole question or conversation. But if we were to go down that road, I think it's really interesting, this idea that maybe sense of humour could be one of the criteria. So if you're thinking, how's my sitting going? Don't think, how long can I sit without moving? Or how many days of retreat have I been on? But where's my sense of humour? Yeah, sense of lightness. And we really can see this sometimes. You know, there are things, I think I mentioned it the other day, that we can see in our own mind that actually become quite funny. You know, something that felt like, gosh, that's a really knotty, painful thing. I need to get in there and sort that and work that out. And there can be these other times when we're just looking at it and, ah, it's the mind doing its thing. The mind doing its thing. And this kind of humour that they're talking about, is, I think, it's definitely not laughing at others. It's not humour that creates a bad other. But something about just the humour of the human condition. And it says in the book, again, really interestingly, that there's a link between all these words. I think the Latin word is humus. Forgive the pronunciation if that's wrong. Which means earth. And is related to the words humour, humility and human. Yeah. The fourth one of these is acceptance. And again, echoing what I was reading from Tara Brach, there's this quotation of a lovely paradox, really, which is, acceptance is the only place where change can begin. Yeah, acceptance is the only place where change can begin. So it isn't the case that acceptance and change are somehow opposites, but through a deep acceptance of this is the way things are now, that opens up a space for creative response. So it says there, you know, the Archbishop didn't accept the inevitability of apartheid, but he did accept its reality. Make sense? So by really, it's no good him saying, well, you know, I don't think there's such a thing as apartheid, I'm going to... No, you accept this is how it was. And accepting that fully then creates the conditions for change. The psychologist Carl Rogers said something very similar, actually. He said, it's only when I can accept myself as I am that I'm free to change. And we often see that, don't we, in meditation, you know, if it's... anxious thoughts or you know, feelings of grief and things. In that place when we really feel those deeply, we really bring a warm and friendly, open, spacious awareness to them. We really bring that kind of perspective of letting them be, that we find they can move through. You may be familiar with the very famous Serenity Prayer, again, which asks for the courage to change that which can be changed, and the serenity or the peace to accept what cannot be changed, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I don't know about you, but when I think about my life, I've made mistakes both ways. When you really think about that, so I've tried to change things that can't be changed. Yeah. Banging my head against a brick wall, as we say. But there have also been times of the opposite, actually. A kind of pseudo-acceptance, which we might call resignation. You know, putting up with something when actually change is possible. I really love that prayer. You know, the wisdom to know the difference is really profound, actually. You know, what a place of acceptance, place of creative change. The next one of these is forgiveness. And the most important thing I feel about forgiveness is really to acknowledge that it's a process and not a demand. I mean, actually, again, my personal view on this is sometimes trying to be too premature with forgiveness can be quite harmful, really. If somebody's really hurt us, if something's really painful, really difficult, and we try and go straight away, oh, I've got to forgive them, got to forgive them, it can actually be really painful, difficult. And actually, because it doesn't honour the process we need to go through, and part of that process is, wow, really contacting the hurt, being with the hurt, having time to move through that. Yeah, so we can see forgiveness as a direction, but not a demand. And really including within any practices we do around that, really acknowledging the pain that's there, the hurt that's there. So the forgiveness comes through moving through that, not through denying that. But properly held, it's a beautiful quality that releases bitterness. Again, in a very human part of the book, actually, the Archbishop talks about his own regrets around his father's death and a difficult relationship he'd had with his father, and the father wanting to speak to him, but him not being able to do that, or not finding time to do that before he died. I was very moved by that part of the book, actually, because again, when you know, as I'm doing today, sharing these stories, these people can become kind of icons, so they're up there, you know. But actually, they're also flesh and blood human beings, and yeah, it's very moving actually to say, yeah, he's got regrets about that, didn't work out as he wanted to, didn't have a neat conclusion. But to me, that also makes this real, you know, what they're saying. But they quote somebody called Anthony Ray Hinton, if you know Anthony Ray Hinton, who was in prison for 30 years, wrongly imprisoned, and was, you know, said he forgave the people who, he got to a place where he forgave the people who put him in prison, and people said, well, how can you do that? How can you forgive them? They took away 30 years of your life. And he said, yeah, well, if I don't, they'll take away the rest as well. Yeah. So, it's extraordinary what's possible for the human heart, isn't it, really? Just to sense that. Yeah. The next one of these is gratitude. And again, as I frame this today, all of these things I'm seeing as a way of helping us to make that journey from despair into what Joanna Macy calls active hope, that more creative, engaged space. And gratitude is very much part of her teaching too. But it's like we need to be open to what's lovely and beautiful and okay and delightful in order to also hold what is painful. And my sense is our capacity to do both are very linked, very linked. Thich Nhat Hanh spoke about this. He said that, you know, the world is both full of dreadful things and also full of beautiful, wonderful things. And to meditate is to be in touch with both. But if we lose sight of what's lovely and beautiful, again, this can really close down the heart. When I practice gratitude, actually there are all sorts of ways you can do this. Actually, one way I learned really quite recently is holding your fingers. I don't know if you've ever done this, but you can hold the way I was taught this. You can hold the thumb, and as you do that, you may actually feel grateful for that thumb as a way to start. The thumb's an interesting thing. I don't know, again, depending on your history, but for many of us, we probably don't think about our thumb very much. And yet here's this thumb that's helped us to get dressed and eat food and everything we've done during the day. If we type, it's helped us to type, move things around. You know. And then you move through different fingers. So you can do things like bring to mind an object around you. You could see that's useful or beautiful. You can bring to mind something in nature. Yeah. So again, just a suggestion, tomorrow when you go home and afterwards, you can think of Gaia House and the trees here, things like that, yeah? It can still be with you. You can think of a person, you know, a little bit like the people we've been thinking of in our friendliness meditations, you know, someone who's been good to you, someone who's kind to you. But you can systematically do this gratitude practice. Another version of these, there are many of these actually, is to go for a walk. You go for a walk in your neighborhood and with the intention to notice what's lovely and beautiful. I had a nice experience doing that actually. I was walking down the street in Nottingham and there was quite a busy road. And I thought, oh, I'll do that gratitude thing. And I was walking down and there was just all this traffic everywhere. And I thought, oh, this is not going to work here. That was the first time. But so I kept walking. And then I noticed that in the garden opposite, somebody had grown these enormous sunflowers. And that they'd really taken a lot of care of their front garden. And then I looked at it. And then someone next door had put up some kind of homemade sculpture that was clearly important to them. But it was interesting. I wouldn't have noticed these. Yeah, again, without the intention to notice that, I wouldn't have noticed them. I think with gratitude practice as well, we can actually have a journey from gratitude towards the kind of things we usually think of as good, like sunflowers and, you know, a healthy body to the extent we've got it, or a beautiful picture in our house. But as we deepen in it, we can also open to something like gratitude for life itself. You know, gratitude for the whole world, the whole universe, the feeling, ah, it's good to be alive. Yeah. Gratitude for the breath, for the whole thing. And, you know, in that there can be this understanding that despite all its pain and difficulties, it's a beautiful world, and really letting that in. The next one of these qualities they speak of is compassion. And the Dalai Lama says, too much self-centered thinking is the source of suffering. A compassionate concern for others' well-being is the source of happiness, he says. And yeah, when I think of compassion, I'm really thinking of the capacity to connect with suffering in the world, pain and difficulty in the world, our own and others, and a steadiness within it. And a steadiness within it. You know, and a wish to respond to that suffering. And I'm really struck with what he says there, that compassion actually brings forth joy. Even though it's concerned with pain and difficulty, the joy is born of the connection. The joy is born of the connection. Again, I don't know if this echoes with you, but sometimes when I think about my own life, the times that have felt tricky actually have been times when I've been a bit more cut off. A bit cut off and a bit too concerned and worked up with things that in the big scheme of things are not really so significant. But there may be other times, like conversations with really good friends, or at times, I remember one experience very well actually, of being with someone who was recently bereaved. And although there was great sadness, there was also this great connection. Because it felt relief to sort of be in touch with what mattered. And this is the beauty of compassion. And the final quality they talk of is the quality of generosity. And talk about how this is valued in so many of the world's religious traditions. I would perhaps venture all of the world's religious traditions. You know, you think of in charity in Christianity and zakat in Islam. And then you get this dana in Hinduism and Buddhism. There's a Hebrew word here which I'm too embarrassed to say in front of you. Thank you, Sadak. I'm going red now. Yeah, I'm going red. Pronunciation's not my strong point. It's a beautiful thing to realize how central this has been. And, you know, generosity really is expressing connection, isn't it? It's expressing a sense of mutuality. It's letting go of the feeling that here we are in these little self-centered bubbles facing a hostile world, doing the best we can. We feel part of something. And one tradition that I know a bit more about is the Sikh tradition. And I don't know if you've ever been to Sikh temples, but there's a lovely expression of generosity there. And one that I've been to many times. You go upstairs to pray and to meditate, and then downstairs you get the food, and the food is all freely offered, and people volunteer to cook the food, to wash up. And my sense is just a lovely kind of integrated practice in that. I don't get the sense that somehow being upstairs and doing the prayers is the real thing, and being downstairs serving the food is not. But they're both, like, it's not kind of one or the other. It's like they're both part of the practice, what you do. Yeah. So, yeah, if you do find yourself at times, very understandably, in that place of despair, you're feeling overwhelmed by all that can feel difficult, and it may be useful to bring to mind these people I've been speaking of, actually, you know, Tara Brach and her newspaper meditation, Joanna Macy and her work, and the Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the Dalai Lama. Of course, there are countless others. Countless others. Are kind of including us too, right, as well, it's, you know, in our own way. I just wanted to just finish by again saying we can always do something. The cognitive psychologists tell us that one of the unhelpful thinking patterns human beings can get into is called all or nothing thinking. All or nothing thinking. So all or nothing thinking would be, if you can't do everything, if you can't solve everything immediately, what's the point in doing anything? Okay? Really helpful to know this is actually a cognitive distortion, they would say. And we can do something. And it's really important to make that shift, because it can just feel so, it is feel so powerless not to make that shift. And, on the first evening, of course, we mentioned the war in Ukraine, and I was speaking to many of you that's very much been with us on this retreat. And I just wanted to share a small thing that happened, which was that I remembered in Nottingham that I actually was going to hire a room from them, actually. So I remembered there was a Ukrainian community center in Nottingham. And I just had the thought, I'll email them and see if there's a fundraising effort that they would recommend. And then they emailed back, they sent me a link, and I offered some donation to that. And I noticed that actually in that particular fund, they'd raised about £1 million. Yeah? Now, that's not going to stop the war. So it's not all. It's also not nothing. Yeah? And yeah, and I really hope and trust that that can provide some relief of suffering. Of course, we don't know how that's going to work out, but just that place, and again, it's like a unshakable faith. Even in the most desperate situations, we can always do something. Yeah, I think this is the grounds of our active hope. So let's take a moment or two just to be still.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.